Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another encore presentation of The Dick Staub Show, conversations with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers about their life, work, and personal journey. Today, we continue our conversation with Dr. John Polkinghorne about his book, Faith, Science, and Understanding.
For many of us, understanding the relationship between scientific pursuit and faith is a personal interest. For our guest this evening, Dr. John Polkinghorne, it is a professional pursuit as well as a personal passion. He's done some very significant work in this area, having authored The Faith of the Physicist, Belief in God in an Age of Science, and more recently, Faith, Science, and Understanding. We've been talking about, from the scientific community, one of the building blocks to building a bridge between science and faith would be the scientific community's willingness to accept theology's place at the table and even its role as an integrating discipline. You get into, in the book Faith, Science, and Understanding, you make the comment there is no universal epistemology.
Yes.
And you start talking about the multi-layered character of reality.
Right.
And the fact that there are different ways of knowing
right.
different aspects of truth.
Yes.
Expand on what you mean by that and why it is so important in this bridging faith and science.
Well, I think it is important. I mean, science is really trying to know the world in an objective way, treating reality as an it, as an object. And that means it's something that you can kick around and pull apart and find out what it's made of. And that gives science its secret weapon, which is, of course, the experimental method. Now, we know that there are other encounters with the reality where we get to know things in a different way. We get to know each other in a different way. Their testing has to give way to trusting. If I'm always setting little traps to see if you're my friend, I'll destroy the possibility of friendship between us. So that's a different way of knowing, which is adapted not to the impersonal world that science describes, but to the personal world of human encounter. And, of course, the transpersonal world of encounter with the divine reality requires yet another way of knowing, which involves worship and awe and obedience. And I think it's very important that to recognize that we don't meet reality in a single way, that we have to conform ourselves to what it is we're trying to encounter and to understand.
You illustrate this within the scientific community
yep.
by pointing out quantum physics
That's
and
right.
the theory of relativity being two of the most significant scientific
right.
Discoveries in the 20th century, and yet they themselves are approached differently, understood differently.
Right. That's right. Yes, I mean, the physical world of everyday experience, which science, of course, does study, is clear and reliable. The quantum world, of course, is cloudy and fitful, and you have to know it in a different way. If you insist on trying to know what's happening inside atoms to the last detail, you'll fail. Heisenberg won't let you do that, and it would just be a pointless mistake to try for that kind of knowledge. You have to accept a different, more veiled encounter with physical reality.
Now, one of the very interesting building blocks, I think, is a way of describing it within this dialogue, is the importance of understanding personhood.
Right.
And how scientific process, almost by definition, certainly by practice, mm-hmm. is trying to eliminate the notion of the person as part of the process, whereas personality and personhood, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. is really kind of an essential element of all human life and all inquiry of truth.
Yes, it's an essential element, actually, of doing science. You're right in saying that science doesn't try to describe its own material in personal terms. That's the restriction that it imposes upon itself and which has enabled it to be very successful. Science is successful simply because it doesn't try and explain everything. But scientists themselves are persons. They have to make judgments about, is this a good scientific theory? An experimentalist has to make a judgment, am I really measuring what I want to measure, or is there something else going on that's contaminating the evidence I'm accumulating? These are acts that you don't read in a book. They come from personal judgment and experience. So scientists are persons, even if science itself is impersonal.
When we think about the understanding most scientists have of revelation,
right?
It is a huge stumbling block for them. They look at Revelation with a certain set of understandings of what that would mean, and it is by definition outside their realm of acceptability. And you would argue, rightly so, based on the way they understand Revelation. You try to give them a different perspective on Revelation.
That's right. I think there's a tremendous misapprehension in many scientists' minds. They think the Revelation is some sort of unquestionable authority. Just shut your eyes, grit your teeth, believe six impossible things before breakfast, because you're told that's what you've got to do.
Yeah.
Now, they don't want to do that, nor do I. I don't want to commit intellectual suicide. And I'm trying to persuade my scientific friends that I have motivations for my religious beliefs, just as I have motivations for my scientific beliefs. Revelation, I think, is the account of those particular events and people in whom the divine presence has been most clearly revealed and discerned. They are like critical experiments, so to speak, or critical observations, perhaps would be a better way of putting it. So I see, for example, the Bible, in a sense, as being the laboratory notebook of the Spirit, in the way that a scientist notes down the results of his or her experiments in the laboratory.
So now this, of course, leads us into a discussion of how theology has to understand itself. Because if scientists have to accept certain things about theology, theology has to accept certain things about science and about its own practice.
Absolutely.
And it strikes me that one of them is this very understanding of what the work of theology is and what the nature of revelation is. Mm-hmm. If theologians are unwilling to meet the scientific community in an agreeable way in their definition and practice of the term revelation, this becomes one of those gaps that is unbridgeable.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think that theologians have to recognize that they are interpreting experience, often, of course, not their own experience, but the experience that's reported to them as a Christian theologian. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the central experience around which my theological understanding turns. That has to be looked at carefully. The evidence has to be assessed and then responded to. And that seems to me as a process that is not all that different from the way in which scientists analyze experimental results.
When you talk about the death, burial, and resurrection, you're talking about miracles. Miracles are also a huge gap for many scientists. They view it as an unlikely intervention or punctuated equilibrium of the miraculous into an otherwise orderly natural world.
Yes, I think they don't realize that there's actually a theological problem about miracle. The one thing that's theologically incredible about miracle is that they are acts of divine showing off, that God says, I'll show them today, and does something that God didn't think about doing yesterday and won't be bothered to do tomorrow. So you have to understand miracles as not as being divine sort of acts of showing off, but as deeper aspects of the divine consistency. That's why, for example, in the Gospel of St. John, miracles are described as signs. They're sort of windows into a deeper level of reality. And we have to make sense of them in that sort of way. They aren't just funny tricks.
But that, of course, raises questions for the scientist on the nature of God's relationship with the natural order and with processes that have been set in motion.
That's right. And the first thing we have to say is that God ordains nature, and the laws of nature are themselves an expression of God's will. I think that the reliability of the laws of nature is a reflection of God's faithfulness. Therefore, God doesn't just tear up the laws of nature. That would be for God to act against God, which wouldn't make sense at all. But I think that the laws of nature are not so tightly drawn that there isn't room within the open grain of nature, both for us to act in the world and for God to act in the world. I also believe that God sometimes does entirely new things in entirely new circumstances, which is how I understand the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Join us next time for a continuation of our conversation with Dr. John Polkinghorne. Thank you for listening to The Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's K-I-N-D-L-I-N-G-S. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.